Secrets and Spies presents Espresso Martini with Chris Carr and Matt Fulton.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Espresso Martini. Matt, how are you?
Hey, Chris, I'm good. It's a rainy day here, dark and rainy day. How are you?
I'm good. You might not be able to tell, but it's actually a bright and sunny day here, but it doesn't look like it in my little home studio because it's nice, dark, and dingy.
Yeah, it's like I said before we got started, we sort of switched weather for the past few days.
Yes, yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's very sunny outside at the moment. My blinds are trying their best to keep the light out, but
yeah, no, I should take like a match and just hold it up so people can see me in the camera better how dark it is here.
Yeah. But yeah, it looks, yeah, it definitely looks more evening vibe than daytime. No. It's quite funny. Yeah. It's good. So we've got a jam-packed episode today. We'll be first of all looking at the latest updates on India and Pakistan. Then we'll be looking at the concerns about loyalty tests in the intelligence services. And then we'll be wrapping up about the debate on Air Force One and its future. So Matt, I'll let you kick off with the update on India and Pakistan.
Yeah, so we have a pretty big update on it, and definitely worth checking in again. So here's some details we're drawing from articles from The Guardian, The New York Times, and also there's a CNN one that I'll throw in the show notes as well. So here's some key points here. So India and Pakistan came perilously close to full-scale war last week, with missiles flying, air bases under attack, and nuclear fears mounting until a fragile U.S.-brokered ceasefire pulled the two rivals back from the brink. The crisis erupted after a militant attack in India-administered Kashmir last month killed 26 civilians. We've covered this previously. India responded with missile strikes on what it called terrorist camps inside Pakistan. At first, the Trump administration appeared unconcerned. Trump said, quote, "They've been fighting for a long time," while Vice President J.D. Vance dismissed it as, quote, "none of our business." Washington's early posture signaled that India had a free hand, with U.S. officials reiterating New Delhi's right to defend itself. But as the conflict escalated, with Pakistan launching retaliatory drone strikes and India targeting key Pakistani military installations, including air bases near Rawalpindi, home to Pakistan's nuclear command, the calculus in Washington changed fast. Fears of nuclear escalation forced a pivot. Trump tasked Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Vice President J.D. Vance with urgent back-channel diplomacy. Rubio called Pakistan's army chief, national security advisor, and prime minister multiple times through the night, while Vance dealt with Indian officials and Prime Minister Narendra Modi. A shaky ceasefire was eventually hammered out by midday Saturday and publicly announced by Trump on Truth Social, where he took credit for preventing a, quote, "bad nuclear war." Pakistan welcomed the intervention and publicly thanked the U.S., while India, consistent with its policy of non-alignment and seeing the Kashmir issue as like a sovereign issue for them, denied any outside influence and framed the truce as a result of bilateral strength. Both sides immediately claimed victory at home, unleashing patriotic messaging and media spin. But despite the temporary calm, the roots of the conflict, especially in Kashmir, remain unaddressed. And with trust in short supply, even senior local officials are warning, don't count on this truce to hold. Chris, what'd you think?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, this one. To me, initially, I would say this has sort of been a huge positive for Trump and his sort of team, because they've helped India and Pakistan obviously negotiate this ceasefire. But obviously, I'll put a little caveat on that.
Yes.
But it goes in contrast to the administration's apparent lack of interest in getting involved at all, which you mentioned. And I can only assume that they realized that the two nuclear armed states getting into a deeper conflict was probably not a good idea. And the Trump administration felt that they would have to step up and broker a deal before India and Pakistan escalated things. So it's good that they finally kind of stepped up and did that. The tag team approach was interesting, having Rubio negotiating with Pakistan and Vance dealing directly with India. It's a timely reminder of the positive and vital role the US can play in world affairs, whilst this isolationist stance will ultimately not serve the US well in the long run. However, obviously, as you've said, despite the current ceasefire, issues over Kashmir persists. The roots of the conflict between India and Pakistan lie in the disputed territory of Kashmir, a conflict dating back to 1947 when the monarch, who was the ruler of the region, chose to accede to India despite the region's Muslim-majority population, which led to the first Indo-Pakistan War. President Trump recently, obviously after this sort of semi-success, has then complicated matters when he posted on Truth Social. He said that, "I will work with both of you to see after 1,000 years a solution can be arrived at concerning Kashmir." This comment was welcomed by Pakistan, which expressed appreciation for President Trump's post. But the idea of the US getting involved in brokering a deal over Kashmir was less well received in India. Mm-hmm. In an interview with the BBC, Shyam Saran, a former Indian foreign secretary, said that obviously it would not be welcomed by the Indian side. It goes against our stated position for many years. Then Jarami Ramesh asked that, "Have we opened the doors to third-party mediation? The Indian National Congress would like to ask if diplomatic channels between India and Pakistan are being reopened." So the Indian government does not appear to be keen or even open to any third-party negotiations revolving around Kashmir itself. And so, you know, as you said, this sort of ceasefire is quite delicate. And sadly, you know, there'll probably inevitably be another sort of spat over this issue. And so time will tell how, you know, if it happens during Trump's, continues on during Trump's term, how they will actually deal with the next phase.
Right.
Because we're sort of seeing different energy levels with regard to Ukraine. And so how will they cope with if this ceasefire gets broken again? So that's the thing that interests me about all of this.
Right. Well, I think that's those are all good points. I think something also here that's key to note is that this truce is sort of like that was brokered is sort of like an opening kind of halt to then negotiate a more comprehensive ceasefire and address some sort of longstanding issues, one of which is really big for the Pakistanis, understandably, as we've talked about in the last episode, how India pulled out of the Indus Water Treaty that really potentially screws Pakistan quite substantially as far as, you know, agriculture, water supply, a whole bunch of humanitarian issues, right?
Mm.
So there's that, this sort of waiting to be addressed or resolved in some way. I'm going to take this conflict and the truce that we have right now sort of out of the larger issue of Kashmir here for a second. Because I do think there are, as far as like a negotiating kind of standpoint, they are a bit separate, at least here for the moment, right? I am pleasantly surprised that the Trump administration saw the need to sort of get off its ass and help negotiate some sort of at least a temporary cessation of hostilities here.
Credit where credit's due, I suppose.
Credit where credit's due. I don't think it, from what we know, it potentially was not any more than Vance and Rubio going out to their respective interlocutors and getting them on the phone together is sort of what it seems like. There was also in the CNN piece that I mentioned that I'll link in the show notes, they had a bit in there that sort of said that into, you know, Friday, Saturday, there was a, on Friday, I believe it was, some intelligence came across the lines that really kind of spooked the administration and then got them taking this a bit more seriously. Because initially from the start of the conflict, as we've sort of said, you know, the administration seemed like, okay, this isn't really for us. We don't really care. You know, I hope they stop and I hope they, you know, get back to normal. But there wasn't seemingly much effort or recognition of there wasn't much recognition of the seriousness of the situation and showing kind of effort to sort of step in and try to mediate this.
Yeah.
There's no indication in that CNN piece or elsewhere that I've seen so far as to what that intelligence could be. If I'm purely speculating, if I'm going to, purely sort of speculate here on what it could be, on that last day, there were a lot of Indian efforts to sort of push Indian operations to push suppression of enemy air defenses or SEED, we call it in their, or they would call it in the Pentagon. And also targeting certain strategic Pakistani air bases, like the one at Nur Khan, which holds a chunk of Pakistan's aerial refueling fleet. And also some of those strikes were in and around Rawalpindi, which is kind of the administrative and operational center of gravity for the Pakistani Armed Forces, the headquarters of Pakistan's Strategic Plans Division, which governs their nuclear arsenal, is there. The last time we talked about this on the show, I mentioned, you know, Pakistani nuclear doctrine calls for the use of nuclear weapons if a portion of Pakistan is occupied or if its air force is destroyed. And I think, again, just purely speculating on what that intelligence could have been that got the Trump administration up off the couch here. Potentially some, let's say, SIGINT intercepts or some other bit of information that came across that suggested that the Pakistanis were seeing those strikes on those strategic air bases on in and around Rawalpindi as sort of pushing the envelope a little bit too far. And perhaps there were discussions, serious discussions, about Pakistan upgrading the readiness of its nuclear forces, perhaps dispersing them outside of storage facilities into the field to kind of A, disperse them from attack, and to so that it would be more readily available to launch them if the Pakistani high command thought that was reasonable. That, of course, being seen by the Indians would be a huge escalation and increase the risk for, you know, all kinds of miscalculations, etc. So again, credit where credit's due. I'm glad that they got off the couch and were able to get the two sides on the phone together and tamp this down, at least for now. I would just, you know, this goes to show how when you have two nuclear armed major powers like this, if they start shooting at each other, you don't, you know, hang out on the couch for a couple of days and say, well, it's fundamentally none of our business. I hope they stop. But, you know, there isn't much room for us to be involved here. That's why you don't wait until some intelligence comes across your desk that, you know, scares the crap out of you and you go, oh, okay, maybe we should take this seriously. Because, you know, eventually in this situation, the potential for that intelligence to come across your desk is or you should know, is highly likely. So you would want to start working before that happens, you know, before that's on the horizon.
Yeah, because once the wheel's in motion, it can be harder to, you know, slow them down.
Absolutely. The other thing that I see here that I find kind of interesting is how this was potentially, I think, a really important opening for Pakistan, not for Pakistan, for China, rather, to flex its diplomatic muscles here and perhaps show that it can be a kind of reasonable, trusted by all sides, intermediary regional hegemon in Asia. Perhaps
they're going for that at the moment, aren't they?
They are. They are. And we're, you know, not, of course, making it very difficult for them. Whether, I mean, potentially you would have the issue then that, you know, the Indians would see that Pakistan, that China is far too cozy with Pakistan to be in that kind of a mediator role. That's also a potential. I am relieved to see this tamped down for now. There is a of course always the potential, likely potential perhaps, that the truce doesn't hold and we see another round of shooting between the two. I don't think it's a given though. Time will tell.
No, I sadly think it's highly likely, maybe not immediately, but it could be a couple of years time there'll be something that will flare it up again.
This is not the last confrontation between India and Pakistan, for sure. Whether that comes next week, next month, next year, the next decade, I don't know. But I'm glad that this instant, at least for now, seems to be tamped down a bit, and I hope it holds. Also, one more point here that I have. As far as the U.S. getting involved with negotiating a settlement to the wider issue around Kashmir, I would be really shocked if there's any kind of serious effort or progress made in that anytime soon. I mean, you sort of said as well, you know, that that's a very prickly issue for India and how they see it as sort of just a bilateral concern between them and Pakistan. But that's a separate matter, I think.
Yeah, indeed. There was one thing just to add to what you talked about earlier about the airstrikes and targets of airstrikes. So in the war zone, They've got a recent article that kind of summarizes some of the sort of latest of the conflict. And apparently there were unconfirmed reports that suggested India had targeted, I don't think they actually struck it, but they had targeted a nuclear facility in the Kharana Hills in the Saragoda district, is that how you pronounce it, of Punjab, Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And that's where Pakistan holds some nuclear weapons and have done nuclear testing in the past.
Right.
And that would have been a major escalation had they had attacked the nuclear, you know, a nuclear base, basically.
Right. That would be a major escalation. It would also be if, you know, if I didn't mention it in the intro because I wasn't sure how confirmed it was or the extent to which the Indians actually took action or targeted that facility. But even if Pakistan had some indication that the Indians were thinking about targeting that facility, crazy escalatory action to do so. But I think that would also force the Pakistanis to discuss, you know, dispersing those weapons outside of those storage facilities into, you know, other protected areas where they could be you know, hidden until the order came, if and when it came, to launch. And that's something that, you know, we would definitely not be happy to see, and that would cause us to get off the couch for sure.
Yeah, because I know the US has traditionally been very concerned about Pakistani nuclear weapons. I believe there are even plans to try and sort of get them out should a certain situation arise.
Yeah.
And, you mentioned that before in an earlier episode.
We've mentioned that in a few past episodes. Mm. There are JSOC has, the Joint Special Operations Command definitely has highly classified plans on the books, or at least they did to respond and sort of sweep up those nuclear weapons in the event of like a jihadist coup, you know, something like that.
Yeah, indeed. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Because I think we've kind of covered everything there.
Yeah, I think important to touch base on this again and to sort of update listeners. I'm glad to see that the White House recognized the seriousness of the moment and didn't leave it to fester any longer. But, you know, your imagination should be able to tell you that a serious escalation of that degree could and likely is coming if you do nothing. Therefore, do not wait for it to slap you in the face to do something. But they did get off the couch and do something, and I'm happy for that.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of an intelligence saying, I think, from MI5, where it's forewarned is forearmed.
Exactly.
And, you know, the role of intelligence is to kind of give you the heads up that something's going on in the early stages. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't wait till it gets so bad that, you know, that it's harder to sort of deal with it. So, I am glad that the Trump administration did at least sort of pivot away from their earlier disinterest publicly. But they do tend to have this thing now, and maybe this is a growing pattern, where they say something publicly but then end up doing something else in private and then come out and try and make it a win. I don't know. It's very difficult to see how that all kind of translates from kind of bluster to reality.
Yeah, is that something, that's a good, you know, question too, then, is that when they say that, do they believe it themselves in the moment? Or is that just sort of a messaging thing that behind the scenes there are? Or, you know, do they say it and then the people, the institutional career people who are left in their positions come out and say, no, I don't think that's too smart. We should do something about this for X, Y, and Z reasons that are entirely foreseeable in a situation like this. That's a, I'm not sure. I can't speak to which of that is the case, but it's interesting.
No, I don't think either of us are in a position to really answer that currently, but one to keep an eye on, definitely. I'm sure as other situations arise, we might start to see, you know, a pattern of behavior that makes more sense with that, but we'll see.
Yeah.
But there we go. Well, I think let's take our first break and be right back with more. Well, welcome back, everybody. So our next story is an interesting piece from the Cipher Brief titled "When It Comes to National Security, Loyalty Tests Should Have No Place." And this is written by General Michael V. Hayden, who is a retired four-star general in the United States Air Force, and he served as director of the CIA from 2006 to 2009. And he was also the director of the NSA from 1999 to 2005. And I believe there's a picture of him with Edward Snowden. Didn't he give Edward Snowden some sort of certificate in Snowden's early days at the NSA? I have a funny feeling I remember that image. They've met each other.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, he was director. I could be wrong, but I have a feeling that's the case. Snowden was around. He was working in the Special Collections Service. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's somebody I would love to get on. I know he had a stroke, which affected his speech, but I think he's made a significant recovery. So I'd love to get General Hayden on in the near future if he feels able to do it. It'd be really interesting to get his perspective on things. Because I think he, as I've kind of come to a bit later, I think he's a very serious and knowledgeable person and somebody one should listen to when he raises the alarm about something. Right. You know, he strikes me as a very kind of straight shooter on certain topics, and this is his area of expertise. So key points from the article. So he mentions National Security Advisor Mike Waltz and NSA Director General Timothy Hawke were dismissed following a meeting with Donald Trump and right-wing activist Laura Loomer, who urged the president to remove officials she claimed were insufficiently loyal. Their removal had nothing to do with policy failures or qualifications. Traditionally, national security roles are filled based on experience and competence, with loyalty focused on the Constitution and the country, not the president personally. The growing expectation of personal loyalty to Trump is undermining that norm. Sound national security decisions rely on a diversity of expert views from military, intelligence agencies, and the State Department. When officials are afraid to speak candidly or dissent, the quality of the US policy suffers. This shift could lead to poor decision-making at home and diminished credibility abroad. Senator Marco Rubio now holds four high-level roles simultaneously, including Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, an arrangement that removes necessary institutional friction and debate. This consolidation, combined with a loyalty-first culture, may deter skilled professionals from public service. So, Matt, what are your thoughts on this one?
I think the first thing is really important here, just to remind folks again, as you sort of said, who Michael Hayden actually is, you know, and that he is not some blue-haired woke activist yelling about microaggressions on TikTok. Mm. You know, this is as you said, a retired four-star Air Force general, former director of both the NSA and the CIA under George W. Bush. This is the guy who is the architect of some of the most aggressive and frankly controversial intelligence programs of the post 9/11 era. You know, a lot of the concerns back then around ethics, enhanced interrogation techniques, I'll say, you know, civil liberties and stuff, as far as like domestic wiretapping and everything. A lot of those controversies that we sort of remember from that time during the heart of the war on terror, he was right in the middle of that, you know, director of the NSA and the CIA through that time period.
Yeah.
So if you were to build a caricature, perhaps, of a hawkish Republican national security official from central casting, it'd look a lot like him. And so here he is warning loudly that the Trump administration's obsession with personal loyalty to the president is not just corrosive, but flat out un-American. So I think when someone like General Hayden, who spent decades in the intelligence world and served a Republican president, says this stuff, it should scare us. You have to stop and listen. Because this isn't about partisanship, I don't think. I don't think there's anything partisan at all about what Michael Hayden has said here.
He probably traditionally swings Republican until, you know, recently.
Imagine was no fan of the Obama administration and certainly probably had many reservations about some of the ways in which the Biden administration conducted its foreign policy. For sure, I think that's very safe to say he would have felt that way. You know, this is about professionalism. It's about how national security actually works. And Hayden is telling us in no uncertain terms that the White House is purging people, not because they're wrong on policy or incompetent, but because someone whispered in the president's ear that they're not loyal enough. It's not only abnormal. I think it's dangerous. This also isn't some abstract beltway etiquette problem. These are people in charge of nuclear policy, cyber defense, intelligence coordination, diplomacy. You want dissenting views in these areas. You need the Pentagon, the State Department, CIA, National Security Council staff to disagree sometimes. That's entirely healthy.
That institutional friction, as he put it, I think that's a very vital thing that a lot of people don't seem to understand.
That's how you test ideas. You know, that's how you avoid disasters. At least me in my own life, if there's people around me who say, you know, Matt, you're great, you're perfect, you're awesome, you're never wrong, when anything I bring to them, you're like, yep, you're right, exactly what you think, boom, first indication, that's just shitty advice. That's not some, you're never...
I call it George Lucas syndrome, but...
Yeah.
We end up being surrounded by yes men on the follow-up to the original Star Wars
trilogy. Right, in the prequels.
Yeah, they didn't end well.
This is not good advice. Like, you are never that right all the time just based on your own gut first instinct. It's just not true of anyone. I'm sorry. It's just not.
Yeah, yeah.
I think what Hayden is describing here is a chilling effect for sure. You have smart, experienced people staying quiet or staying out of government entirely, getting out of government perhaps, because they know what happens if they speak up. If your boss is going to fire you because a conspiracy theorist influencer from social media...
And 9/11 truther, crikey, yeah.
Right, a 9/11 truther, no doubt, says, you know, you didn't clap hard enough for the dear leader. That's not loyalty, that's paranoia. That's dysfunction, and it's not how any serious country is supposed to run. So for all the talk we hear about restoring strength, restoring deterrence, restoring order, this is the opposite, I think. This is weak, brittle leadership that equates personal grievance with national interest, and people who consider themselves conservative, especially who've historically voted Republican, should take a hard look at what General Hayden's saying here. Because even if he's this worried, then maybe it's not just the other side making noise, I would say.
Yeah, talk about strength. I mean, there's like true strength and then there's performative strength.
Exactly.
And I think true strength is what Michael Hayden described, where you have these sort of dissenting views and very educated and smart people actually sort of who understand the issues, discuss these policy issues and have a kind of a back and forth to make a good decision. Whilst performative strength is where everybody just appears to be in synchronization with each other, no matter what they say. And I think that's a really bad thing. And I think, you know, there's a lot of examples of this in the business world, let alone, you know, politics and the intelligence world. And obviously, it kind of reminds me of the early days. It reminds me of the KGB a little bit and where it could have got to. But you've got a point there, I think.
Performative strength insists upon itself. Performative strength is not concerned with its own operations and its own endurance over time. It is concerned with people simply seeing it as strong and fearing it. And that's not real strength. You know, it's like that line from Game of Thrones, you know, any true king does, I'm paraphrasing here, but any true king does not have to keep, you know, yelling that I'm the king. Mm.
Or even if in economic terms, you know, the idea of keeping up with the Joneses, where you project this idea that you're super wealthy, got it together, got a perfect marriage, whatever, whilst behind the scenes you're in great debt because you're buying all these new cars and perfect clothes, etc. And then your marriage is suffering because of the stress over money. You know, it's kind of a bit like that too, you know, it's a similar kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so appearances can always be deceiving. And that's the one thing I've learned about intelligence, actually, is not everything as it seems. And, you know, people who are sometimes who project the image of being the most trustworthy can actually be the most duplicitous, you know. There are plenty of examples of traitors and things that do that.
Yeah.
So, got to be so careful about that. So kind of lots of analogies there. So apologies about that. So obviously there is this big danger that US intelligence services as a whole could end up being served by yes men who are afraid to speak truth to power. And we'll start to curate information based on how it will be perceived by the sitting president. And that's very dangerous. Now, as far as we know, the US intelligence services has gone to great lengths to avoid this situation, though one could argue there have been times in the US government's history in which its relationship with intelligence has been questionable. And I would quote the Iraq War and how intelligence was curated to build a justification for the US invasion has been well documented. And to note, that effort was actually led by the Bush administration. It was not the intelligence community telling or forcing the Bush administration to go on a path to an invasion. The Bush administration clearly wanted to invade. They saw the 9/11 attacks were a good opportunity to do that, and they sought intelligence to justify that position. Because I have noticed a lot of people over the years tend to get it the wrong way around. They seem to think that it was somehow the CIA went to Bush and said, hey, let's go and invade Iraq, and hey, here's all the documents. When in fact, it was the other way around, where the Bush administration went to the CIA and said, we want to invade Iraq, we need information about it.
Or people like Rand Cheney or Rumsfeld created certain new intelligence structures within the Pentagon that their marching orders were certainly to sort of take anything that came out of the traditional intelligence community that was going against the idea that, you know, Iraq, weapons of mass destruction stuff, and pour cold water on that.
Yeah, indeed. So with loyalty tests, lessons from that chapter of history will get passed over or possibly see more abuses of power via politically led intelligence than before. So that's a real concern there. And also then there's the other risk that intelligence services might start wasting resources on the wrong thing and not putting enough focus on something more important. And certainly there were certain aspects of the US focus on the war on terror, you know, which did have some very important aspects, but there were other things like, you know, the intelligence to facilitate and sustain the invasion of Iraq, which pushed resources away from the hunt for bin Laden. Yeah. It also pushed resources away from deterring Chinese and Russian espionage against both the US and its allies. And we kind of live in that world now, thanks to some of that. And then obviously this loyalty test approach, which we've seen in the current administration, you know, leads to candidates who are considered unqualified by their peers, and they're kind of pushed into areas of great responsibility because they're because of their loyalty to Trump. And they also get protected, as we've seen with Pete Hegseth, who shared classified details in these signal messages in the now infamous Signalgate scandal, yet he has not so far really faced any serious repercussions for sharing those details on an insecure app. So this is the other side of it as well. So as we said at the beginning, and I'll finish it up on there, General Michael Hayden is an experienced man, and when he issues concerns about something, people really need to listen. So sleep well.
Well said. I mean, if there is... between stuff like this and, you know, the gutting of the FBI or orienting DHS entirely to be just super hyper-focused on immigration, all of that stuff, right, that's going on right now, if there is some major catastrophic terrorist attack, there will be no shortage of indicators of, well, how did this get passed? This, you know, how did this get through? How did we miss this? We know damn well how they missed it.
This is it. And yeah, you mentioned earlier the FBI and ICE. I mean, all I see on their social media is how the FBI is involved with, ICE operations now, which is not really the remit.
Talk about performative strength.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, I'm assuming it's curated to make Trump happy, but, but it's the MAGA base, but not good. So yeah, concerning. All that's concerning. Is there anything else you want to add on that?
No, great piece here. Would love to, you know, certainly would be great to have Michael Hayden on to speak about this in a bit more detail if he is available at some point.
Yeah, willing and available. It'd be good to get him on. So yeah, we'll see what we can do. Well, but let's take a break and we'll be right back with more. So our next piece is an even more kind of interesting tit-a-tat.
Grift Force One, yeah.
Oh my, is that what they call it now? I like it. So I'll hand this over to you.
Yeah, so I'm drawing from two really good articles here from, this one's from Garrett Graff on his Substack, and there's the other one that that The War Zone did. This is a really good breakdown of just, you know, the cost and the man hours that have to go into this proposal, but here we go. So this week, a story that sounds almost too absurd to be real. President Donald Trump is moving to accept a quote unquote gift from the Qatari government, a customized Boeing 747-8, a flying palace once used by the Qatari royal family, to serve as an interim Air Force One. The $400 million aircraft would be outfitted with military upgrades and pressed into service until Boeing completes the long-delayed VC-25B replacements. Then, in a twist that has raised a blizzard of ethical red flags, the plane would transfer to Trump's presidential foundation as a permanent fixture of his yet-to-be-built library. Setting aside the constitutional concerns, the proposal has triggered serious alarm among national security experts. The idea of placing the president aboard an aircraft once operated by a foreign government for more than a decade raises staggering counterintelligence and cybersecurity risks. Even a total strip down and rebuild of the aircraft wouldn't erase the inherent vulnerabilities. Then there's the timeline. Trump reportedly wants the jet operational by the end of the year, but that's nearly impossible unless you cut a whole bunch of corners. The current Air Force One aircraft, so, I mean, I think most listeners probably know this, but Air Force One is just a radio call sign that is taken upon by any Air Force aircraft that the president is currently on. But so the current Air Force One aircraft that, you know, you traditionally think of as Air Force One, known as VC-25As, are based on the now antiquated 747-200 platform and are notoriously expensive and difficult to maintain, costing nearly $180,000 per flight hour. Their successors, the VC-25Bs, are 747-8i airframes undergoing a massive retrofit effort that's already billions over budget and years behind schedule. Upgrading the Qatari jet for presidential duty would require not just secure comms and attack countermeasures, but also structural and power generation overhauls at great cost and in a condensed window. So them saying, oh, it's just $400 million, it's going to cost way more than that to put this thing into service, as like up in the billions. As one Air Force official put it, meeting the strict requirements for secure presidential transport is non-negotiable, especially the president's ability to connect to the National Command Authority under any conditions. Cutting corners to fast-track this jet for a couple years of Trump's use doesn't just defy logic. It could jeopardize core elements of U.S. nuclear command and control. In the end, it's hard to see the gesture as anything but a high-risk vanity project with a kleptocratic sheen, and one the Secret Service, Air Force, and national security community will be hard-pressed to defend. And I finish that just as the lawnmower drives by. Chris, what'd you think?
I was trying to work out if that was a plane or a motorbike for a second, but it's actually a lawnmower.
Air Force One. It's the junkyard Air Force One that's flying over, and an engine's going to fall into my bedroom overnight, just like Donnie Darko.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, what an interesting kind of topic, really, on so many levels. And I just realized, looking at my notes, I've kind of only really focused on the plane stuff and not even into the ethics, because there's a whole ethical thing there.
We could do a whole episode on this. It's one of those things that, like, you look at and it's like, where do I even begin? You know, like working on these sort of notes to go through and talk about, it's like, what do I focus on more? You know,
the
Qatar, Hamas, Taliban hosting issue? Is it the cost, ethical, kleptocratic nonsense of it? Yeah. Is it the national security issues? Is it the sort of technical infeasibility and just general unnecessariness? That's not a word, but I'm using it, of this whole thing. Like, there's just, it's a target-rich environment, but I'll let you go, Chris.
Totally. It's all of that. Yeah. It's all of that. So I'll focus a bit on the plane stuff for now, and then, you know, we may or may not go into all the other things. But I mean, obviously part of the problem, aside for President Trump's desire for a new plane, is that Boeing is taking so long to get these new ones ready. And you've mentioned before the Boeing 747, which the VC-25A is based on, is no longer in production. And for the VC-25B, Boeing had to go out and seek some Boeing 747-8ISs because they don't make Boeing 747s anymore. So in the end, they did find two planes that were built for a defunct Russian airline, and they were found to be the only planes kind of available that were to fit the Air Force's requirements. And then conversion started on those planes in 2019. In specialist hangars constructed at Andrews Air Force Base. So why? Now, I understand it's a complicated thing. And obviously, Boeing is a very professional company that has, like, all sorts of ties to military. So exactly why it's taking as long to convert these two planes, there's only two planes, with all the necessary equipment to make them secure and suitable for the president to fly on is a little bit beyond me. And I am surprised it is taking this long. And I know I'm not alone in feeling this way. Other journalists and aviation stuff have expressed similar concerns. So now, Matt, did you have something else to say to that? Because you look like you did.
Well, there's... Boeing has had numerous issues over the years.
Oh, yeah. On its Boeing 737
right,
Max.
Right, with this, yes. Numerous issues with this. It's just one more monkey on their back, I'm sure. But
yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, just to sort of, this is a recurring issue with presidential aircraft, you know, the fleet that is under the ultimate control of the White House military office. So the replacements for Marine One, you know, the classic VH-3D, was it a Sea King? Yeah, the Sea King.
Yeah,
variants.
It is a sort of variant of the Sea King.
Yeah, that had been used.
Which we've long retired ourselves.
Well, yeah, that had been used. I think it was first started being used under Reagan or Bush Senior that had been in service for a while, right? So the program to upgrade those into, was it VH-37, I believe, is the designation.
Yeah, which is based on a more modern airframe, but
Yes. So that program to replace the helicopters that are traditionally used under HMX-1, that Marine squadron, have also been through all kinds of issues for years, was ongoing during Trump's first term. And recently, the first time that a president flew on those helicopters, on those new helicopters, was Biden flew on it last summer during the Democratic National Committee to get from Chicago's O'Hare Airport into the middle of Chicago by the convention center where the DNC was taking place, right? So that's, you know, that had been ongoing for years, went through all kinds of issues. I think the bulk of the issues were on the communications suite that are on board these helicopters, was getting that right. And they'll still be, I think the VH-3s won't be entirely phased out until about 2030 is what the schedule is right now. So this takes a presidential aircraft, whether that's, you know, rotary or fixed wing, takes an enormous amount of time and effort to get it right, because these are such like just custom off the shelf, one of a kind aircraft. It's true of the limousines also. I mean, yeah, it's technically, you know, based on a Cadillac limousine, at least like the body is. Other than that, those limousines have more in common with like a tank than they do, you know, a limo that would pick you up and take you to, I don't know, would take your kids to like the prom, you know, more in common with a tank than a limo like that.
Would have. The VC-25B is going to have, obviously you mentioned communications, it's got special secure communication systems. It's also got classified capabilities that we don't know, which I'm assuming are around defense. So you probably got some sort of electronic anti-missile system, maybe chaff dispensers, and possibly a light degree of armor for probably small arms fire, I would imagine.
Small arms fire for sure, degree of protection against that. And we also know just from photos and analysis of the VC-25As that have been in service for almost 40 years now. Yeah, there are various countermeasures for surface-to-air missiles, such as, you know, chaff, flares, probably been upgraded to some sort of IR kind of laser system as well. But the exact details of that and what would be in place on these new aircraft, that's classified. Yeah. But we can speculate that it's along those lines.
You can't just slap this stuff on a new plane. Basically.
No, which is what's so I don't understand and I haven't really seen this much anywhere. It's just like why I get Trump is really kind of obsessed with this plane in particular. Like there's a big model of it that's on the coffee table in the Oval Office. You can see it in all kinds of pictures inside the Oval Office. It's there. So he has this kind of weird personal obsession with this aircraft. But I haven't heard any indications from the Air Force previously that the two VC-25As, 747s that are typically Air Force One that pop into your head when you think Air Force One, that they're somehow unsafe to fly and operate. That I haven't heard that at all. I think it's just he wants a new plane and he's fed up that he has to wait so long and that he may not be able to get to use it before his term expires. I think that's it.
That is the issue. I think he wants a new plane because there's a certain status with having being the first president on the new plane that every president will fly on. And also this idea that because the plane's 40 years old, it's now no longer... To most lay people, the older something gets, the less safe you think it is. Whilst with aeroplanes, I wouldn't say it's the reverse of that, but old planes, like the B-52 will probably stay in service till it's 100 years old.
Yeah.
Maybe even longer.
Oh, certainly.
And it doesn't mean it's unsafe because those planes get changed, they get, you know, inspected, etc.
The last B-52 pilots are in like elementary school right now.
Yeah.
And that's been in service since the 50s, that airframe.
There's nothing physically wrong with the plane at all. It's just it's an old model. So it's like going around in a classic car, basically, when everybody else is maybe, you know, going around in something slightly newer. New's not always better. But I think Trump just seems to be in this mindset that he doesn't like the interior. I think he's never liked the interior, and it's the interior you can't change. It's not like the White House where you can change things.
Yeah, it doesn't have that gaudy Middle Eastern dictator chic that he's looking for.
Which the Qatari jet does. If you look inside the picture of the Qatari jet, it looks very on point for Trump. So I can understand.
Which creates all kinds of issues. Like, this is just so patently ridiculous. To that point, Laura Loomer, who we talked about in the last segment, was on Twitter saying, like, I love Trump. I would take a bullet for Trump. But this is like, this is icky. I don't like this. This doesn't make sense. Right?
Loyalty's now, going out the window.
Yeah, really. We got to, ship her off to the gulags.
Yeah, be gone with her. Sorry, Laura, you're done.
Yeah. In order to sort of do this, okay, so you take the airframe of this 747, right, that the Qataris are giving us, supposedly, that's worth $400 million.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You would then, between the Air Force, the White House Military Office, which includes the White House Communications Agency, the Secret Service, Air Force Materiel Command, which oversees like life cycle management of aircraft and development of new aircraft and such, you would take these. One, is it two 747s or is it just one?
It's just one from Qatar, I believe. Obviously, the Air Force have got two. The Air Force have two that they're converting currently.
You need two. So you have a decoy and a spare that you can, like, if one breaks down on a foreign trip somewhere and you can't get the pieces part for it right away, okay, we'll put the boss on the other 747 to fly home. So there's issues with that.
Yeah. Well, the Air Force ones as well have the, so this is why the 747 or the VC-25s are important, because they have the capability in a nuclear conflict that it could all be run from that. I don't think even the other jets that the Air Force have all of that capability.
That gets tricky. So this was a problem back during 9/11 on that day, right? So Bush and his crew, they were famously at that elementary school in Florida when they found out, right? And then they took off. And then Air Force One went out over the Gulf of Mexico on those first few hours with a fighter escort and everything. The communication suite on Air Force One at the time was not nearly sufficient to conduct, you know, the conference calls and all the meetings and stuff that they needed to do in those immediate hours after on 9/11, right? Which is why they landed at Offutt Air Force Base near Omaha, Nebraska, which is the headquarters of U.S. Strategic Command, right? And there's a well documented, you know, how they went down, and there's a pillbox that was on the front lawn of the building where Stratcom is headquartered. They went into that pillbox on the front lawn and went down into this bunker onto the facility, and where they had, you know, the communications equipment stuff that they needed to, you know, meet about 9/11 at the time. That's all since been upgraded dramatically on Air Force One on these same aircraft since then. But no, to that point, I mean, they would have to strip the aircraft down to the bare fuselage, right? So all the gaudy Middle Eastern dictator chic fittings and interiors, that has to go, right? And then you kind of have to build it back up again with these really sophisticated, advanced, secure, classified communication suites, countermeasures. There's all, like, it's just.
You know what they could do, Matt? You know what they could do?
What's that?
Take the interior from the gifted jet, just shove it in the ones that they're already working on.
Yeah, just.
And they might just finish it in time.
Right. Just give him a gold plated toilet and, like, he'll be happy or something, maybe. I don't know. It's just like put a tanning bed in the front, you know, and he'll be like, okay, I can use this now. But the idea that they would be able to do all of that, which would cost billions, the process that I just explained.
And especially it would cost more if you try and speed it up unnecessarily as well, because you have to throw money at the problem.
Absolutely. So you're taking a program that is already over budget, over schedule by years, and you're making it so much worse.
Yeah.
To potentially cut all kinds of corners around national security and safety and counterintelligence and all kinds of those issues. You're cutting all those corners just to give him a plane that is aesthetically more pleasing to him that he can then use for a couple years, all of this done at the public expense. And then after that, okay, he says it's going to his presidential library and that it would eventually be like a fixed exhibit at the library. Like there's an old Air Force One that Reagan used. I think it was the model before the VC-25As came online that is at the Reagan Library in California. He says that that's what it would go to, but there's no indication that would happen immediately, that he then wouldn't keep flying around in this for his own purposes. Afterwards, it's something that just patently makes no sense, that is just so egregiously corrupt and wasteful and unnecessary and self-obsessed, that just so goes above and beyond that you have people like Laura Loomer saying, hold on, I'm not sure about this. It's insane. It's insane.
Yeah. I was just looking at the Boeing C-32, which is kind of dubbed Air Force Two.
Yeah, that the First Lady and the Vice President and the Secretary of State use. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, if you're all about saving money, theoretically, you could just use that plane instead.
You could. Yeah. And sometimes the president does use those aircraft for...
President Biden used it a lot.
Yeah. Obama has used it before. I'm not sure if Trump used it at all in his first term. I would be surprised if he did not set foot on it at all.
It would make sense for domestic flying because it's two engines, which saves money on fuel.
Yeah.
I think the 747 is probably better for international stuff, but the 757, which the C-32 is based on, is more than capable to fly abroad and do refueling stops.
I could see real reasons why consistently using a C-32 for presidential airlift operations would not be a perfect option in the long run. I see reasons for that. But I also go back to he wants to do all this stuff just for himself, just for a couple years, when there's nothing actually wrong with the current Air Force Ones. There's nothing wrong with it. So he's going to, again, we're going to, okay, with the economic message and stuff around the tariffs and stuff, he's saying that your kids at Christmas time, maybe they only need two dolls or they need five pencils instead of like hundreds, but he's going to get a new plane simply because he wants one at public expense. When, you know, we have this huge deficit issue, when, you know, there's all kinds of, we got to cut spending or we're going to go broke and I'll be yada, 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 yada. And then he's going to get to keep it afterwards. It's just utter. I mean, good luck at the midterms with this message.
Oh, no, totally.
There is no way that the Air Force and the Secret Service, the White House military office, can ever be 100% certain that that aircraft is entirely secure for presidential use.
Yes.
None.
No. Because there could be bugs deeply in it. I mean, the one example I was going to bring up was the US Embassy in Moscow, which was discovered to have bugs, you know, built within the building structure. We don't know where this plane's been and who's had access to it. And it would require probably months, if not a year plus, just to do a proper check. Because a lot of these devices might be so deeply embedded in the airframe, they might not even be switched on. You know, it's not like you just go and get a magic wand in a movie and go around doing a bug test. It's not quite that simple.
No.
My worry is, so he's going to be gifted this jet. And we know Trump is a bit of a, should we put it politely, he's a bit of a maverick and kind of is known to do his own thing despite what people tell him to do.
Just putting it politely,
Yeah. And my concern is that he'll order a repaint of the plane, which will probably happen, and he might just start using it despite what people tell him.
Like after he's out of office?
No, I mean, in office, whilst in office, I could see it. I could see it happening. I could be wrong, but I could see him doing it.
There is, which is to the point that, like, if they do this, if they take this airframe and they modify it and go through all the stuff that would need to be done to make it even remotely suitable for presidential use, it costs billions of dollars and takes years, probably just as long as he has left in his term to do so effectively, right? The only way he gets around that is if he says, no, just put me on it anyway. And I don't know where the friction comes in with the Secret Service and the Air Force putting the National Command Authority on a plane that is entirely not suitable for use. It is crazy town is the clinical term.
It is. And I you know, I won't say it is going to happen, but I could see it happening. Only time will tell.
I don't know. Time will tell. As of this recording, I don't know that this is entirely... This is one of those things where, like, you see it once in a while where they float something, they come out with something, and they're so high on their own supply that they don't really see how this is going to play in advance. And then the backlash is just so patently like, you're doing what? Why? You know, something even like Laura Loomer's coming out like, I'm not so sure about that, that they then tend to, I don't know. And I just get back to, there's nothing actually wrong with the current Air Force Ones.
No, not at all. So it's all for show.
Yeah.
So it's all ego-driven and performative is the way I say it is, but, you know.
Yeah, the current Air Force Ones that have been used by presidents of either party for 40 years, it doesn't have a gold-plated toilet, and there isn't a tanning bed in the front, so he can't use it. I can't think of... There is no other reason.
Yeah, no, indeed. Well, that is us for today. Now, a couple of things before we leave you be. So we're not going to be doing an espresso martini next weekend. So we're taking a small break. So that means there will not be a show on the 24th, but there will be a show on the 31st of May. And that show, we would like some listener questions. Now, we traditionally do listener questions sort of on our last show of the month. So please drop us an email at secretsandspiespodcast@gmail.com. Send us your question or the topic. Send us a link that's relevant to the topic you would like us to discuss. And please also include how you'd like your name read out on air and, you know, the attributed location, whether it's, you know, you could say just the country, you can say your town. Don't say your street address because that's probably not a good idea. But, you know, just give us a general idea of where you are and where we can read it out. We did get some listener feedback regarding our episode in Australia, but I'm going to save that for the episode on the 31st because it's good to consolidate feedback and put it into that show rather than every week kind of having a major feedback session. However, if we get a lot of feedback all the time, then we might change that. But for now, I'd rather just save that to the 31st so we could address it properly and even incorporate into, you know, our kind of question and answer session. So that will be out on the 31st of May, which is a Saturday. So please get your questions and topics in by the 27th of May. Get them in. We have some interesting episodes coming up. I've got a very interesting one on the kind of connection of sort of pagan beliefs between Ukraine and Russia coming up with Ross Downing. That's going to be quite a detailed episode and quite niche, actually, and quite unique. And there will be an element of it that will benefit people watching on YouTube. So if you don't traditionally watch us on YouTube, that particular episode, there is a section that will be of a great benefit to you if you watch it on YouTube, because we're going to be looking at some images of symbols. But I'll remind you in that episode to do that. And then apart from that, just a huge thank you to everybody who has been supporting this show, listening to us regularly. You know, we're as I mentioned in previous episodes, we really have been seeing a massive bump up in the last few months, which is very encouraging.
Yes.
And, you know, if you're enjoying the show, please do leave a review, because as you may have noticed, we've been bombarded with a lot of negative reviews in the last few months. And it'd be nice to kind of get the balance back to what I think is a fairer place. So leave a fair review. You know, if you'd like what we do, say that. If you think what we do is good and you're in the middle, fine. If you don't like what we're doing, fine. I'm sorry you don't like what we're doing, but, you know, but I'm pleased to say that I think the majority of people who do listen to this show on a regular basis do seem to like what we're doing. Just, you know, keep us posted on if there's anything we could be doing slightly better, or if there's something you want us to talk about. You know, that's what we want. So, Matt, anything for you? You want to mention before we part company?
No, I'm very eager to hear that episode that you just described. It's an interesting one.
Yes,
I've heard it in the pre-production and a bit since it was recorded. I'm eager to hear it myself. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. No, Ross is a fantastic guest, and it's going to be very detailed and yeah, very, very interesting. And you know, I honestly, it was something I didn't even really think about until Ross approached me. And I was like, oh, this is very interesting. And it kind of links in nicely with a few kind of requests we've had from, you know, from regular listeners as well, to talk about some of the religious aspects of both the war in Ukraine, and even some of the things around sort of the rise of the far right in Western culture as well. So we're doing, you know, we're sort of slowly crafting some episodes that are kind of that will cater to that. So yeah, so bear with us. So thank you again, everybody, for listening. Just a reminder, we're not on next week. We will have those interviews coming out. And then apart from that, we will see you on the next show. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll catch you next time. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.